This is Here's How, Ireland's political, social and current affairs podcast, presented by William Campbell.
Thank you for downloading episode 55 of Here's How. Last week, a forensic dig confirmed the suspicions of local historian Catherine Corliss that hundreds of babies' bodies were disposed of in a sewage facility by Bon Secours nuns in Tuam. In this podcast, I'm looking at how that story was treated in 2014.
Here's How is Ireland's political, social and current affairs podcast. Make your view heard. Just dial 076 603 5060 and tell the world what you're thinking. Your voicemail may be included in the next podcast. You can find tips on recording your contribution and other ways to contact the show at hereshow.ie/call.
Normally, when I do an editorial piece, I put it at the top of the podcast. I'm going to leave it to the end in this particular edition. The reason for that should be obvious when you listen. I'm splitting this into a two-part podcast because I have two interviews and I think they're both relevant and I thought it was worth including them both in full. In a few days, I'll put online an interview with Bill O'Donoghue of the US-based Catholic League, but I want to first include this interview with Brendan O'Neill. He's the editor of Spiked Online. One note about it, he sometimes mispronounces the word Tuam as tomb. I just wanted to mention that because it might cause confusion in the context.
Make your view heard. Dial 076 603 5060 and leave a contribution for the show. You can find tips on how to record a good contribution and other ways to contact the podcast at hereshow.ie/call.
I have on the line now Brendan O'Neill. He is the editor of the online magazine Spiked Online, and he's also a writer for The Spectator magazine. Brendan, in 2014, when the story of the tomb babies first appeared, you wrote a fairly polemic column on Spiked Online about that. Is there anything about that column that you would maybe have done differently?
No, not at all. I stand by it completely. That column made two points. The first point was that in 2014, no bodies or skeletal remains had been found at that point. And the reason it was important to point that out is because lots of the media coverage was actually saying that bodies had been found. I mean, this was in the headlines on some newspapers, 800 babies' bodies found in tomb. So I just said, that's not true. That's not correct. And we have to wait for the excavation before we can see how true that is. So it was an argument to wait for an excavation. And then the second point I made was simply to challenge the idea that these babies had been dumped into a sewage system. Uh-huh. And I said it seems more likely that some former water treatment facility had been turned into a kind of crypt. That's what it looked like to me. So I was just calling into question those two aspects of it while saying that it's unquestionable that homes like this had high death rates and that children were buried there. That seemed unquestionable from the very beginning to me.
Okay, I want to read out just a few little excerpts from it. You say, thanks to a Twitter mob constantly on the hunt for things it might feel ostentatiously outraged by, the story about babies being dumped in an old out-of-use septic tank by nuns at a home for fallen women in Tuam in Galway made waves in every corner of the globe. Then a few days later, having finally strapped on its boots, the truth, or at least a more sober analysis of what might have really happened in Tuam, staggered onto the stage, and it was a very different story. Then later on you say, on almost every level, news reports in respectable media outlets around the world were plain wrong. You say, clearly this isn't about news anymore. It's about a desire for facts or truth that elevated the crazed claims about Tuam up the agenda, rather a mishmash of anti-Catholic prejudice. And then at the end you say, these history-combing Catholic bashers employ the very same irrational tactics of demonology and myth-making once beloved of Ireland's old Catholic establishment. That kind of indicates you write for, you know, Spiked Online is obviously a polemic website. You don't make any secret of the fact that you're, I wouldn't quite call you a British Breitbart, but you're certainly, you've certainly got a right-wing agenda there, and The Spectator is a right-wing magazine. It does seem, though, that you're accusing people of having an agenda when, in fact, the stories have turned out to be substantially entirely correct?
Well, Spiked's not a right-wing magazine. Spiked's a left-wing magazine. We call ourselves Marxist libertarians, which people think is a contradiction in terms because they don't understand what it means to be a left-wing libertarian.
We can do another interview on that at some other stage. I'll accept that. You also write, I think, for The Telegraph, which isn't known for its left-wing chops. But to put that aside.
Although one of the pieces I recently wrote for The Telegraph was about my history in the Marxist movement. Anyway, so all I'm saying is I'm not right-wing. Spiked is nothing like Breitbart. And I entirely stand by that article, because the thing that I was saying was wrong in the media coverage was the claim that bodies had been found.
Well, a small number of bodies had been found by a couple of children at that stage.
Yes.
And Catherine Corliss said that she had documentary evidence which proved that in the region of 800 children had died and their burials had not been recorded in any way.
Yes.
And she speculated, and she wasn't in any way making any bones about it, but she speculated that they may have been hidden or disposed of in this particular facility.
Yes. Now, she also said that her research had been widely misrepresented, that she never used the word dumped, and that's one of the things that I took up in my piece.
Well, yes,
the
media's use of the word dumped. That's from an Irish Times article that she disputed at great length.
But however, if you just look at lots of people seem to have forgotten what I actually wrote in that article. All I wrote in that article was to say that headlines such as 800 skeletons of babies found inside tank were incorrect. And all I said was that they were incorrect because the skeletal remains had not yet been found. And I mentioned the children who remember seeing around 20 remains when they fell through the top of this contraption at some point in the 1970s, I think, or the 1980s. So I mentioned that. And I also say that it's highly likely that there are bodies there. The question that remains is why was there this media rush to say the bodies had been found when they hadn't yet been found? That's not a small fact. That's a huge matter of factual interest. And more to the point, can we really say that they had been dumped into a sewage system? And then further to that, there was this rush to describe it almost as an Irish Holocaust and to compare it to some of the worst crimes in history.
Brendan, just to get the background facts on this, for example, in 1943, in that home, 34% of all the children in the home died. The next year, 44, 25% of the remaining children and new children who had come in died. In 1945, the figure was 23%, and the next year it was 27%. So between a quarter and a third of all the children in the home were dying each year.
Yes.
That is not just problematic. That's not some just poor conditions. That is indicative of a very extreme situation.
Yes.
And I can accept that comparing it to a concentration camp or something, I can accept that that is perhaps overly polemic, but it is, if you were affected by that, you can see how it doesn't seem like an unreasonable comparison.
Yes, but you seem to have mistaken me for someone who's going to defend the tomb home or the Catholic Church. I'm not going to defend either of those institutions. I'm an atheist. And I was a Catholic and I abandoned my faith. I don't have any faith whatsoever now. And in my piece that I wrote in 2014, I described these places as harsh, unpleasant places in which women and children were profoundly mistreated.
Well, you did. Let me just get exactly what you said here, because you said that there's no doubt that life was grim in that home in Tuam as it was across the west of Ireland in the early to mid-20th century. That's simply untrue. There is absolutely no comparison between life inside that home and life outside it.
Okay, but in terms of children dying before the age of five, there is a comparison.
Most certainly
the death
not.
Rate was
Most
higher. The death rate was higher in the home, but the death rate among children in the west of Ireland in the 1930s, 40s, and 50s was high. I know this from my own familial experience and babies in my family who died.
Infant mortality is measured as a percentage of children who die before the age of five.
Yes.
Given that those figures that I quoted, there was a large input of children, but if you had extended those figures across the west of Ireland, you would have had an infant mortality rate of in excess of 100%. It was never anything like that. Infant mortality in Ireland at its worst was in the region of 10%.
Yes, the infant mortality was higher in these homes because these homes, as I said
off
in my
the
piece,
scale higher.
Were deeply, deeply problematic places in which fallen women, as they were scandalously called, were forced to hide from the world, and they lived in horrible conditions. No one is going to defend that, as far as I know. Maybe some extreme Catholic will, but you'd have to talk to them if you want someone to defend these institutions.
That's not what I want to do.
What I'm interested in is a number of things, but firstly, I'm interested in the rush to paint this, the rush to use this as a means of demonizing almost the entire of Irish history. And there's an element of virtue signaling with this. But what you have is this contemporary Irish establishment, which feels so disgusted by its own history that it is continually looking for things that it can virtue signal against. And that's why, actually, no one can wait for all the facts to come out from Tuam. Even following the commission's latest statement about the discovery of significant numbers of remains, there still is this rush to extrapolate as much as possible from that discovery and to make sweeping moral claims about the depravity and the cruelty and the evil. And I think the moral judgment is running ahead of the facts. And I find that very interesting and also very worrying. I don't think it's a good way to discuss historical events.
Brendan, I'm just interested in how you came to write about that. You said you have a background in revolutionary communism. You don't, and I've looked at your website, you don't typically write very much about Ireland, even though you obviously have an Irish background once removed. Did you talk to anybody who was a representative of the nuns or anybody else in Ireland before you wrote that article?
No, my piece was an analysis of the media coverage. That's all I wanted to do. All I was interested in was the media response to Catherine Corliss's study and her claims, mm-hmm. and her Facebook post where it originated. And I was interested in the media response to that. And the thing that most struck me about the media response was, firstly, the false claim that 800 bodies had been found. Now, in 2014, that was an unsubstantiated claim, and I think it's problematic of the media to make unsubstantiated claims.
But Brendan, every day in almost every tabloid newspaper, you can see the overextension of claims. And Catherine Corliss said that it was probable that these children were buried or interned or disposed of in this place. The newspapers amped that up and made a probably into a
and you definitely. Think that's acceptable?
I don't know. And however, as it happens, Catherine Corliss in her probably has turned out, so far as we know, to be correct, and all evidence that we have from the dig tends to confirm what she said, and there's nothing to contradict it.
But that doesn't change the fact that when in 2014, when BuzzFeed said the bodies of 800 babies have been found in a septic tank of a former home, that doesn't change the fact that that was incorrect.
At that time, yes, they jumped the gun. There's no question about that. But I want to
be
interested,
and
I
still
can accept
remains
it's entirely
unproven.
Correct.
The question, but even now, the question of the number of bodies. Now, unless we're saying that it doesn't matter for the media to get its facts right, that's not important. I mean, is that what we're saying? That it's not, when it comes to an issue of such moral importance as the way in which women and children were treated in the past, which I agree is an incredibly important issue, are we saying that it's so important that facts don't matter?
I think facts matter very, very much. But once in a while, we have to look at which facts matter. And I think that there has been a movement, and I'm interested to see if you're aware of it, there's been a movement to focus on facts of very little importance, such as whether or not the septic tank was in use at the time that the bodies were buried. When, if you step back, you've got nuns illegally and secretly disposing of the bodies of hundreds of children. That latter point seems to me to be enormously more important. And if you keep a sense of proportion on that, yeah, sure, newspapers, including broadsheet serious newspapers, ran ahead of the known facts. But as far as we know, it's all correct. And what I'm really interested in, because you said no, but I just want you to be clear that you're confirming you didn't have any, you weren't in touch with anyone who prompted you or who supplied you with information or background to write this article.
No, it was entirely about analysing the media coverage that I saw, which was everywhere. I mean, it swept the entire world in 2014, and I was interested in the tone of it and the information that was being put forward. I think
I want to focus on that. I'm not sure if you're aware, there is a very well-known Irish PR company called the Communications Clinic, which is run by a very well-known Irish woman called Terry Prone.
Yes.
And a producer, a French TV producer, published an email which she received from Terry Prone, which the nuns involved saw fit to pay the, I think, very large fees for her PR consultancy. Terry Prone said, and I quote, "If you come here, you'll find no mass grave, no evidence that children were ever buried." And the local police force casting their eyes to heaven, saying, "Yeah, a few bones were found, but this is an area where famine victims were buried. So, ? 2 years before they instructed Terry Prone to write that letter, the same nuns were writing to relatives of the victims of the children who died, confirming that they did know that there were burials on their grounds. They lied.
Mm-hmm.
And they are sometimes portrayed as dothery old ladies who aren't really sure about what's going on. They're not dothery enough that they can't hire a high-powered PR firm to go out and lie for them.
Yes, I don't know what you want me to say. I think they are wicked women. And I went to a convent school. I have no illusions about nuns and how unpleasant they can sometimes be. Of course, in our convent school in North London, we didn't suffer anything like that, but they were not the nicest people in the world. I'm not here to defend nuns. I'm not here to defend the Catholic Church. I'm not here to defend Tuam. I know the west of Ireland very well. I spent large amounts of my childhood there. I know the history of how the Catholic Church treated the poor of the west of Ireland, and it was horrible. All that I'm interested in, I'm interested not in defending the Catholic Church, but in looking at the obsession with Ireland's darker historic moments. I find that incredibly interesting. There is this trend among the Irish establishment or the Irish chattering class, or however we
want
to refer to
it. Roll that back a bit. You said that a couple of times, Brendan. You're saying this is amongst the Irish establishment. Actually, with the exception of one newspaper, the Irish Daily Mail, which is an offshoot of a newspaper. I don't know what your thoughts are on it, but it's not one that would typically impress me. But with the exception of that one newspaper, this story is getting remarkably little traction in the Irish press, and it is getting, with the exception of one or two radio programmes, it's getting remarkably little traction on talk radio in Ireland, which is a very important medium in Ireland. And overwhelmingly, this is the interest in this is coming from social media. That doesn't speak to me of an elite who are amping up the story.
Well, who uses social media? Social media is typically, Twitter in particular, is used by time-rich people. These are not ordinary people for the most part. But the point is that it goes way beyond the story of the Tuam tank. This has been a trend in Ireland for 10 or 15 years. You can see it in commissions into child abuse, into abusive homes, into evil priests. You know, the misery memoir industry, which has published book after book on life in Magdalene laundries and so on.
But your point on that is essentially seems to be that this is about the past. And for people living in Ireland, that's not necessarily true. One of the posts shared very widely is written by a woman who in 1981 was forced into a mother and child home, was treated abominably. I don't want to describe in gory detail, but certainly was the subject of what could only be described as a long series of criminal assaults. Somebody having read your piece without much knowledge of it, somebody perhaps outside Ireland, and your website is I guess mostly UK focused. Mm-hmm. Somebody reading your piece could quite easily have taken away the idea that there was nothing to see here. Another piece written for Forbes magazine, which I'll talk about in a little bit, written for Forbes magazine, explicitly said that in 2014, the same time that you wrote this, explicitly said that the story was a hoax. And there, we know that the nuns were paying high-powered PR firms to talk to overseas journalists and lie to them. And we see showing up in high-powered publications like Forbes magazine, as well as on your own, stories
you
that either explicitly said...
Are you suggesting that they paid me to write this article?
I'm not suggesting they paid you, but I think it's...
Are you suggesting they contacted me?
I asked you, and you said that that didn't happen, and if...
They
did not
contact me. No PR firm contacted me. No nun contacted me. If they had, I would have hung up the phone. My article does not say the tomb story is a hoax. It says the home was a horrendous place, and it acknowledges that
because you say that the life was grim as it was across the west of Ireland, and that sentence specifically is untrue. Would you accept that?
How much do you know about the west of Ireland?
I know quite a lot about the west of Ireland.
Right. If you knew anything about the West of Ireland in the 1940s, 50s and 60s, when my grandparents were having children, mm-hmm. you would know that life was extremely difficult. I'm talking about Connemara. I'm talking about mm-hmm. outside of Galway City. Mm-hmm. Life was incredibly hard. Children regularly died and were not buried in the nicest of conditions. So, and I say in my piece,
but
and
25 to 35% per year death rate. That is not as there. Yes, both were bad, but there is a very, very wide difference between the two. And saying,
I said that to you. There is a wide difference between the infant mortality rate in these homes was higher because these homes were not nice places. Everyone accepts that, apart from perhaps a few Catholic extremists. I don't know. So the infant mortality rate in the homes was higher, but the infant mortality rate in the west of Ireland was also high. And when I say that life in the west of Ireland was grim, I'm speaking from stories that I have heard from my own family about the difficulty of life in that situation. And one of my concerns with the way in which tomb and other instances in Irish history are being talked about at the moment is that elevating them into the realm of evil and cruelty and, you know, the depiction of these nasty nuns and these wicked priests actually takes these issues away from the more fundamental political and economic factors that contributed to the backward development of Ireland, the absolute poverty that many people lived in, particularly the kind of people who would find themselves in these kinds of institutions.
Are you sure you've got the direction of causation correct? Are you sure you've got the direction of causation correct? You're saying that these homes were hard because they were in the 1940s Ireland. A biography of Fianna Fáil, or a history of Fianna Fáil and De Valera, is called Preventing Progress, because that's essentially what they did. And the a central focus of the church and the political establishment that was answerable to it at the time was to prevent any reform or any change. So I'm not sure that these homes were following a pattern in society of being backward and cruel. It's possible that they were leading it.
No, my argument is that we should stop speaking in the narrow moralistic terms of cruelty and evil, because the harshness of life in parts of Ireland, and it was harsh. I don't know why anyone would argue that life was nice in the west of Ireland in the 1940s.
Seems like a strong man. Nobody has argued that.
I can assure you it wasn't. But you've challenged my description of it as grim. You said it wasn't grim. For many people, it was grim, I can assure you. But all I'm saying is that I would really like to see this discussion taken out of the narrow moralistic realm of cruelty and evil and placed within the larger context of what was happening in Ireland at that time, which was the church was very dominant. The economy was not in a healthy state at all. Poverty still existed in large parts of the country. children had a very bad start in life. All these things must be factored in, because otherwise what we do is we single out a group of old nuns and say, you're evil and you're the face of Evil Island. And we ignore the broader historical, political, economic questions that created a situation in Ireland in which people lived in pretty bad conditions, both economically and morally. But I just want to come back to one point, which I think is incredibly important. Mm-hmm. My interest in this is not to defend these nuns. It's not to defend the church. I've got no interest in defending the church. I have nothing to do with the church, and I never want to again. My interest is entirely in looking at this trend in Ireland for combing over history in what I think is a quite ugly and voyeuristic way sometimes. Now, I'm not saying we should not criticize these nuns. People can say whatever they want about these nuns. And if anyone wants to bring criminal charges against them, I don't have a problem with that at all. I'm interested in this quite myopic and dark obsession with the worst things that happened in Irish history, which
can I comment on that, Brendan? Because first of all, you're referring to history. And I think perhaps, and I know you have Irish connections, but you don't live in Ireland. For many people in Ireland, it's not history. It's now. 90 or more percent of Irish primary schools are controlled directly by the Catholic Church, despite the fact that they're funded entirely by the taxpayer. And there is a very active rearguard battle going on by elements in the church to retain as much of that control as possible. Mm-hmm. And you're saying that perhaps the story in the 1950s is not what you're most interested in. You're interested in what is happening now. And I think to one extent you're correct, and I've criticized you on something, so let me agree with you on something. I think that this is about a battle that's happening in 2017. And the battle is over who has moral authority now. And there are, behind the scenes, high-powered PR firms being used to minimize and belittle any of the crimes committed by the church in the past, but not only that, to minimize and belittle the problems caused by having what is essentially a theocratic state, at least in its education elements. And you have said that you wrote this article off your own bat, and I accept that entirely. I accept you're telling the truth. And I think it's notable that other journalists who were involved, who wrote about this, despite not having any record about writing about Ireland or these topics, and wrote in very polemic terms saying that it was a hoax, have refused to speak to me.
But by the way, I've written about Ireland. I've been writing about Ireland for 20 years. So this is not my first article on Ireland. I've been writing about Ireland since I was 20 years old in numerous magazines and publications. So I write about Ireland a lot. The point that you make about PR firms, you know, that doesn't even surprise me. The Catholic Church is on the defensive. It's under attack, and it's under attack for very legitimate reasons on many fronts, because lots of what it did in the past was wicked. Lots of what it does today is still, as you say, this desire to keep control over education in particular. So I'm not surprised that it's using PR firms to do that. And I hope people are very skeptical when they are approached by a PR firm, which is obviously employed by the Catholic Church to push a certain argument. But I'm also worried about the other side of the discussion, which I would argue is the more mainstream side of this discussion in the Irish media and in the Irish political class, which is precisely the idea that you've just hinted at, which is that the past, Ireland's dark past, has this kind of terrible impact on the on people in the present, and almost there's this idea that Irish people suffer from almost post-traumatic stress disorder, and that it's caused all these problems in the here and now. And you particularly see that with the Irish government's setting up of commissions into child abuse and past horrors and so on. It promotes this idea that people's lives have been permanently damaged by this, and I think that's also. Well, I think that's also this is a profoundly unpopular point of view, and I got booed when I made it at a speech in Dublin a few years ago. However, it's my point of view. So I think that is a pretty fatalistic idea, and also a potentially quite damaging one.
Let me put the counterpoint to you, Brendan. I agree that there's a plethora of commissions and inquiries and so forth, and I agree that most of them should not exist. And the problem is that they are an excuse to have, to not have what we should have, which is a criminal investigation. And there is anybody who is acquainted with the political machinations in Ireland will know that when a politician doesn't want something to be investigated, they will set up a commission of inquiry, because they tend to take years. They're run by friends of the people who are being inquired into, particularly the McAleese report, and they tend to come up with some wishy-washy recommendations a decade down the line when whoever was in charge is either retired or dead. So I think we're agreeing from coming from different points of view.
Well, I'm not convinced by the idea of having criminal investigations, however. It depends how far back this stuff goes, because can you imagine? I mean, firstly, if someone's dead, if the alleged abuser is dead, then a criminal investigation strikes me as a complete non-starter. You can't put a corpse on trial.
We have the Irish finance minister this week showing up to be photographed in front of the Bon Secours new hospital being opened, a multi-million pound hospital which is profit-making and owned by the order of nuns, who are now all multi-millionaires. That sends a signal, and there is a pushback. And I have to say, I think you're entirely wrong to say that it comes from the establishment. I think it's very much a grassroots movement of disgust.
The key point I want to draw out, just a couple of quick points. The first is that as far as I haven't seen anyone question the idea that life in those homes was terrible, or the idea that people have a right to tell their stories and to say what happened and so on, and that the truth ought to be discovered. All that I would say is that we must keep in line with facts, and we mustn't allow our desire to engage in demonology against certain parts of the Catholic Church to get ahead of discovering all the information. I mean, I thought that's what journalists did. Journalists found out information and made judgments on the basis of it. My second point is simply that I do think there is a problem in Ireland at the moment. And I think that the Irish political class and the Irish media class have very little vision of what the future of Ireland ought to look like, or where Ireland is going. I think there's a real crisis of political vision in Ireland at the moment. And as a consequence of that, I think they are continually drawn back into history. They're continually drawn back into demonstrating their goodness and their decency through juxtaposing themselves with the past. And I think that's why this trend has grown over the past 10 or 15 years.
Brendan O'Neill, thank you very much. Of Spiked Magazine, you've contributed a lot, but I have to cut it there. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Never miss a show. Follow at Here's How Podcast on Twitter and like Here's How on Facebook for updates on each show's contents.
As you heard there, I have plenty of disagreements with Brendan O'Neill, but I do think he is right, at least to a degree, in one aspect. The controversy over the Tuam babies is as much a battle for the soul of Ireland in the 21st century as for the truth of what happened in the 20th century. Previously, I've talked to people like John Hamill of Atheist Ireland, who wants to reduce the almost total control that the Catholic Church has over education in Ireland, and I've talked to David Quinn of the Iona Institute, who wants to maintain it. And whether either of them would admit it or not, the fitness of the Catholic Church to hold that power, and power in other areas of society as well, their fitness to hold that power is judged in many people's minds by their past actions. A large majority of people in Ireland want to reduce the role of the Catholic Church in education, but that is not necessarily the top item on their political agenda. The more focus that can be put on the sins and the crimes of the Church, the more urgent that reform seems, and the more difficult it is for politicians to resist that reform. This point is not lost on the people who want to hang on to that power. In 2014, as you've heard, an amateur local historian paid thousands of euro out of her own pocket and spent countless hours of research and established that about 800 children whose death certificates showed that they died at the Bon Secours Home for Mothers and Children, did not have any matching burial records. Through her local knowledge, she concluded that it was likely that the bodies were disposed of in what is otherwise an underground sewage treatment or storage facility, on the grounds of the mother and baby home. Unsurprisingly, this made international headlines, and it's true that some of the reporting was a bit sloppy. One reason it made such a huge story, I think it's true, is because it fits a narrative. People like stories that fit their perception of the world. And this story fits the narrative of holy Catholic Ireland ruled by cruel clerics. But the main reason that this was a huge story is that it's a huge story. The first reason it's a huge story is the death rates. And in this, Brendan O'Neill is absolutely wrong. I misspoke in the interview. Infant mortality is the proportion of children who die before their first birthday, in the first year of their life. It's measured per 1,000 live births, and Ireland does pretty well on this. To put it in context, Afghanistan is the worst in the world. They have a death rate of 115 per 1,000. That's horrendous. It means that nearly 12% of babies never have a first birthday. The only other country over 100 is Mali at 102. African countries typically have around 60 per 1,000. South Sudan, for example, a terribly deprived country, has 66. South and Central Asia does better. India has 30 per 1,000, Turkmenistan has 37. That's better, but it's still very bad. The United States has 5.9 per 1,000. Cuba famously does better at 4.6. And the EU average is 4. Ireland is better than the EU average at 3.7. But that's now. In the 1940s, Ireland's infant mortality per 1,000 was 66, 20 times higher. So it's true to say we were a third world country then. It's the same rate as South Sudan now. In the 1950s, it dropped to 37 per 1,000, only 10 times worse than it is now. Only 10 times worse. So when Brendan O'Neill says that this was in some way comparable to the death rate in the Bonsecure mother and baby's home, he is utterly wrong. In 1943, 34% of all the children in the home died. Get that in your head. More than one-third of the kids who were alive at the start of the year were dead at the end of the year. That is the equivalent of an infant mortality of 340. That is three times worse than the worst country for infant mortality in the world, Afghanistan. And it wasn't a one-off. 25% died in 1944, 23% died in 1945, 27% died in 1946. Sure, a rate of 66 per 1,000 outside the gates was third world terrible, but there is simply no equivalence with a rate of 340 within the gates. And anyone who says there is either can't count or is hoping that you can't count. And this matters. The way we know it matters is how furiously the Catholic Church is spinning. Terry Prone is the mother of the prolific broadcaster Anton Savage. She's the protege of Bunny Carr, and she's married to Tom Savage, the former chairman of RTE and incidentally a former Catholic priest. She is legendary for her work in PR, and her firm, the Communications Clinic, has a number of high-profile and no doubt high-paying accounts, such as media training for the Garda top brass, on the taxpayer's dime, by the way. She was hired by the Bonsecure nuns in 2014 to handle their media relations. A French journalist, Saskia Weber, published an email she received from Terry Prone. Prone was trying to persuade Weber not to do a documentary on the Tuam baby story for French TV. We know for certain that Terry Prone either lied or was lied to by her clients. The email reads, in part, "If you come here, you'll find no mass grave, no evidence that children were ever buried, and a local police force casting their eyes to heaven saying, yeah, a few bones were found, but this is an area where famine victims were buried. So, we know that this is a lie, because 2 years earlier, the head nun of the Bon Secours wrote to a relative of a child who had died in the home and who was trying to locate the remains. The head of the nuns said, as I understand it, therefore, there would be a good possibility that his remains were buried in the small cemetery at the home itself. This is located at the back of the home and was operated as a general grave. 2 years later, the order were telling journalists, through their PR guru, that this general grave did not exist. Terry Prone went further. She wrote, if you'd like me to point you to a few reputable historians who might be good, I'll certainly do that. The clear implication being that Catherine Corliss and her work were not good or reputable. I contacted Terry Prone to comment on this, but her assistant said that she would not be commenting. So we have no way of knowing how many other journalists were contacted to put them off writing a story that the Bon Secours nuns didn't like, or to encourage them to write a story that they did like. But we do know this, there was a concentrated trend in the media of stories that undermined Catherine Corliss's research. The stories frequently took one detail from a report and purported to refute it and take from that that the entire story was untrue. Rosita Boland of the Irish Times is an experienced and professional journalist. She wrote, under the headline, Chewam Mother and Baby Home, The Trouble with the Septic Tank Story. And her story started with the sentence, I never used the word dumped, Catherine Corliss tells the Irish Times. I never said to anyone that 800 bodies were dumped in a septic tank. Now, a casual reader of that article might get the impression that Catherine Corliss was undermining the story that had been written about her in the international press. Rosita Boland then lists headlines from The Guardian, Al Jazeera, The Washington Post and others, and the impression is that Catherine Corliss is admitting that most of the story is made up. Boland actually uses that word, admit. She writes later in the article, Corliss admits that it now seems impossible to her that more than 200 bodies could have been put in a working sewage tank. But in fact, Catherine Corliss was only disputing the use of the verb dumped, in the sense that she doesn't make any claim to know how carelessly or respectfully the bodies were put there. In a blog post, Catherine Corliss's daughter, Adrienne Corliss, specifically disputes that sentence and complains that her mother was misquoted. In response, Boland published a long letter that she wrote to Adrienne Corliss, and she says that she has recordings to back up her quotes, and I'm sure she does. As I said, Rosita Boland is an experienced and professional journalist. But that's just the point. She's an experienced and professional journalist, and Catherine Corliss isn't. If a journalist writes something on the basis of an interview, and the interviewee feels that the impression of the article is different to what the interviewee had to say, then something has gone wrong. I wanted to ask Rosita Boland about this, but in a very short telephone conversation, she told me that she had nothing to say on the matter. This was by no means the only false impression. Dermot Ferriter is a professor of history at UCD. This is what he told one Dutch journalist.
And, you know, this erroneous assertion that 800 bodies were dumped in a septic tank, that is not true.
I also exchanged about a dozen emails with a journalist called Eamon Fingleton. He wrote an article for Forbes magazine, an extremely well-known magazine. This was strange because, as far as I can see, Eamon Fingleton doesn't typically write about this sort of thing. His usual topics are economics and global politics. The article on the tomb story is, to say the least, a polemic against the press. The last sentence of Fingleton's article reads, "The image of nuns consciously dumping babies in a septic tank is one of the most irresponsible press hoaxes of modern times." Get that, he says it's a hoax. And the headline on the article is, "Why that story about Irish babies dumped in a septic tank is a hoax." A hoax doesn't mean a mistake, it means a deliberate lie. Fingleton is making a specific claim. In fact, he's making two specific claims. First, he's claiming that the story is untrue. And second, he's claiming that the press is deliberately trying to convince you it is true when they know that it's not. And throughout his article, he is blaming the press, and that's the word he uses, he's blaming the press as a whole, which is strange for a career journalist. As I say, I exchanged about a dozen emails with Eamon Fingleton. He agreed at first to do an interview, but then changed his mind. I sent him a list of written questions and he sent back a series of essentially non-answers. I'll put them on the show notes on the website, along with links for all the research in this piece. One question I asked him was whether he had any contact with Terry Prone or her company or other representatives of the Bon Secours nuns in writing the article. He said that as a journalist he wouldn't reveal his sources, which wasn't what I asked him to do, but in any case it was clear that he wasn't going to answer. It's notable that Fingleton included in his article a list of claims that he said, without providing any examples, were claims made by the press, and he demanded in pretty extravagant language that the press should prove each item on his list. I asked him what evidence he had to prove that the press had perpetrated a hoax, as he had claimed, but again, he didn't answer. The Tuam baby's story is a grim tale of people in the last century who acted in a most despicable and inhumane manner. But there is another story to tell here too, one that's happening right now, in this century. One of an attempt to bury a story even deeper than those babies are buried. And there's not much glory in this story either.
Do you agree? Do you disagree? If you want your point of view heard, dial 076-603-5060 and leave a contribution for the show. The lines are open 24/7 and you can find tips on how to record a good contribution and other ways to contact the podcast at hereshow.ie/call.
That's almost the end of episode 55 of Here's How, Ireland's political, social and current affairs podcast, published on the 9th of March 2017. As I said, there are links to all the sources that I used in this piece, along with the questions I sent to Eamon Fingleton and the replies he sent. They're on the show notes on this podcast's page on the website. If you can think of a topic that you think should be covered in a future show, or if you want to suggest someone to include, and that could be yourself, then let me know. If you like the podcast, please go on iTunes and give it a rating or even write a nice review. That very much helps other people to find the podcast. Also, please like the show on Facebook. Please follow the podcast on Twitter at Here's How Podcast. Follow Catherine Corliss' daughter, Adrienne Corliss, at Adrienne Joko. And follow Brendan O'Neill's Spiked magazine at Spiked Online. And of course, subscribe to the podcast so new shows automatically come up in your podcast feed. You can use iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, or any other podcast app or software. If you don't know how to do that, there's full instructions, recommendations for free podcast software, and also contact details for the show, all at www.hereshow.ie. The second part of this podcast will be uploaded on Monday, 13th of March. I'll have an interview with Bill Donohue of the US-based Catholic League on this topic. Please do subscribe so that you get that and all the future podcasts. The Here's How podcast is produced and presented by me, William Campbell. Thank you for listening.